Hello and welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. This is episode 33 for January 19th, 2010. My name is Ben Snakeuff, and I'll be your host today. Today, with me, I have
Dominic Remy,
David Liu,
and David O'Brien.
We've got three stories for you this week. First off, the First Circuit Court of Appeals has revived an antitrust suit against the Recording Industry Association of America. Secondly, ValleyWag has put a bounty on Isolate rumors and Apple's trying to stop them. And last of all, Apple has filed for a patent and Engadget thinks that it's been that the patent is precluded because of prior art on the Android. And we're going to talk to you a little bit about that toward the end of the podcast. So to start out, we've got this First Circuit ruling that revives an antitrust suit against the RIAA. Now, essentially what happened in this case is a person filed several lawsuits all across the country. They were consolidated into one action in, I believe it was New York. Second Circuit, I'm sorry. They were consolidated to New York, and the judge in New York dismissed the lawsuit, saying that the person in their complaint, they didn't state enough claims to, they didn't state their claim properly, and that they hadn't, even if they could prove everything in their complaint, it wouldn't show that the RIAA violated antitrust law. That person appealed to the Second Circuit, and the Second Circuit took a look at the case and they said, you know what, even under these relatively recent pleading standards, and more strict pleading standards, you did plead a case. You put enough information in there to prove, if you know what you say is correct, that all of the recording industry teamed up. They talked about what their prices were going to be, and they decided to fix their prices. And this is specifically for digital downloads. Now, all we really have to go on in this case is the Second Circuit opinion. So, could one of you two, one of you three, really any of you, give me a bit of a rundown on what the facts are about this case? Because these were filed a long time ago, 2005 and 2006. So, you know, what organizations were we dealing with?
So, there were a number of recording labels that were involved on the defendant side of this lawsuit, and I think it included EMI, Sony BMG, and Universal, and maybe even Warner Music too. So, what they had alleged basically was that these labels were acting in conjunction with each other and sort of colluding on the back end to form something like a price fixing conspiracy, or at least a conspiracy that amounted to a restraint on trade, which is really the law that was at issue here, and that's embodied within Section 1 of the Sherman Act. And specifically what the plaintiffs had alleged was that these companies together formed two joint ventures, which I think were known as MusicNet and PressPlay, and through a series of agreements with each other and special terms that were included within those agreements and possibly some that were included as side letters in those agreements, they had basically engaged in a sort of a restrictive licensing scheme whereby they were maximizing their profits altogether. And you have to remember that these are all separate music labels, and so they were basically saying, well, we're going to provide online music for subscribers at a certain dollar amount, and we're going to fix like a price floor to it, whereby we're not going to offer it below this one level, and I think that was about 70 cents per song or so. And we're also going to impose certain DRM restrictions on it, so we're going to require that the consumers who are subscribing to our services can't do specific things with the files that they're downloading, and that could include whether or not you can burn a CD or burn the music to a CD, whether or not you can make additional copies of it, what devices you can use it on. That would include whether you can use it on the computer that you signed up with the service with, or if you have like a second laptop or your iPod devices or any other MP3 player devices. And that was sort of the basic components of what the complaint alleged. And as you mentioned, Ben, at issue here was that the defendants, all these music labels, had filed what we call a 12B6 motion to dismiss for the failure to state a claim. And basically what they were saying was that the plaintiffs hadn't alleged enough facts in the case in order to make a valid complaint at that pleading stage, and therefore on those merits the case should be dismissed. And as you also noted, the district court granted that dismissal, and it was appealed up to the Second Circuit, which then reversed. And they've remanded it back down to the district court for further proceedings. which basically means that that 12b-6 is no longer valid, and the case is going to go forward from there. But that doesn't affect the merits of the case. This isn't a decision that says, yes, we believe that there is some sort of price fixing that is actually going on. It merely says that there's enough facts that were pleaded in order for the case to go forward, at least probably to the discovery phase.
Right, and that's a good point. Kevin Starr, one of the lead plaintiffs in this case, has actually decided that now that it's been remanded and that the case is going to go forward, he's going to try to make this a class action. So anyone who purchased music from MusicNet or Press Play has the chance to recover in this case. Now, on the flip side of that, we're probably going to get to see another case before this case even gets decided. You know, if the lower court certifies the class action and says, you know, yes, you can go forward as a class action, the recording industry and the defendants in this case are almost certain to appeal that, saying, no, you can't, you know, have a class action in this case, and these are the reasons. At first blush, though, it looks like a pretty good case for a class action. You've got damages that are going to be consistent across all of the plaintiffs. It's going to be difficult to join all of the plaintiffs individually. It's going to be a lot easier just to have, you know, everyone represented in one big chunk. Now to go to a bit more to the legal side of this, in 2007, so 3 years ago now, the Supreme Court released a case called Bell Atlantic Corp. v. Twombly. And this is the case that first heightened the pleading requirements, and that was an antitrust case. And basically what it said is, if all your complaint says is you've got a bunch of groups who acted the same way, it's called parallel action, you know, they all did something at the same time, or they all, in the case of Bell Atlantic v. Twombly, all of the defendants in this case, which were the Baby Bells, were acting the same way to make it difficult for new phone companies to come in. They were, you know, using their local monopolies to try to keep people out. That alone isn't enough to prove that there's an antitrust conspiracy going on. And for antitrust, there has to be some sort of agreement in restraint of trade. It can't just be people acting in their own best interests, you know, kind of together. They're, you know, let's say there are two jewelry stores and both of them face increased costs and both of them raise their prices. If they raise their price at the same time, if they raise their price a similar amount, that's not an agreement in restraint of trade because they didn't agree to do anything. They were just acting in their own self-interest and both agreeing to, in both, I'm sorry, not agreeing, both raising their prices at the same time. Bell Atlantic v. Twombly said, you know, if you say that, that's not enough. You have to prove, you have to at least allege in your complaint that they got together somehow and that they were trying to, you know, they had an agreement that they were going to act together, in, I guess, in restraint of trade. Is there, David or Dominic, is there a better way to phrase that, you know, other than just saying in restraint of trade?
Not that I can think of off the top of my head, but the point I wanted to make was, isn't there something in antitrust law about, like, silent price leadership? Like, sort of wink, wink, nodge, nodge, I'll raise my prices first, and then everyone follows me quietly without any sort of agreement and meeting?
Yes and no. My guess is you wouldn't be able to. So if that goes on for long enough, and it, you know, back in the day, I think what you're thinking of, there is a series of cases or where the cigarette companies would raise their prices in lockstep. You know, every year it was like they'd raise their prices a quarter every year and at the exact same time every year. So they weren't really competing for prices; they all just silently agreed to raise their prices. And yes, that can lead to antitrust liability, or at least it could before the antitrust revolution has occurred over the last, you know, 10 or 15 years with the recent Supreme Court. But especially in Bell Atlantic v. Twombly, there just wasn't any evidence of that kind of thing. It was just a group of individual defendants who were acting in their own self-interest to protect their monopolies. It wasn't a case where they were acting in lockstep with, you know, a nudge and a wink. That really wasn't the case here. Now, this case, though, with the recording industry, the one that we're talking about now, is a lot different. There were a lot of things that led to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals here deciding that there was enough in the complaint. And one of these things was, and I cannot believe that this happened, but one of the recording industry execs put something called the Most Favored Nations Clause in the contract. David O'Brien, can you talk a little bit about what a Most Favored Nations Clause is?
Sure. We typically see these actually in international trade agreements, and I rarely see them in domestic side contracts. But a most favored nations clause basically permits if there's a bunch of people that are in agreement with each other. We'll say that you have a bunch of different music labels who have agreed together, three out of the five major ones, for instance. If the fourth next major one wants to also be a part of this agreement, and he requests that you have a most favored nations clause within the agreement, what those clauses will do then is, in the language of them, and they can be worded in a number of different ways, is it will basically afford all of the best terms that were provided to the three people that were already in the agreement to that fourth person that wants to come in. And so it sort of sets a term floor, almost, meaning that no one's going to get a better term than somebody else. Everyone's going to get the same deal as they come into the agreement.
Right, and we saw this in the licensing agreements. If somebody wanted their music on one of these services, they'd have to sign a contract that included a most favored nations clause saying, I'm not going to give better terms to any other digital music distributors. And what was shocking about this, well, first of all, David, you mentioned that you don't typically see these in America, and there's a good reason for that. And the reason for that was...
just not in domestic contracts. You see them in America in international trade agreements a lot. That's why it's a most favored nations clause, because it often has to do with the terms that are afforded to another country in a, you know, some sort of multinational agreement. But you just don't see them so much in like a... they're very unfavored here, because obviously they raise antitrust issues, because if you're basically colluding... I don't want to say colluding, because it's not always a matter of colluding, but if you're getting together and agreeing with a bunch of competitors together, and you're ensuring that everybody is going to get the same terms, it sort of takes a little bit of the competition away from, you know, one person being able to grant better terms to another person.
Right, and in fact, one of the person who was drafting these contracts said as much. There was a document introduced along with the complaint that said something along the lines of, we're putting this most favored nations clause in, but we're putting it in like a side addendum to the contract so as not to attract antitrust scrutiny, which it's really not the type of thing that you ever want to write down on a sheet of paper, that you're hiding something away lest it garner antitrust litigation investigation. Well, and indeed,
I mean, to be a little bit fair, I think there are some circumstances where you can have something like a most favored nations clause. Like if you have an industry where there are a lot of different competitors in it, and if your agreement, which includes multiple of those competitors, you know, to offer a product or a number of services together, that's probably less anti. That's less likely to garner antitrust scrutiny than would be if you have all of the major competitors in like an oligopoly where you have, you know, five or six different service providers, like the music labels here. That's much more likely to get anti-competitive scrutiny or antitrust scrutiny.
Right. I believe the complaint said that something along the lines of 80% of all music was available through this service. You know, so the vast majority of music, and certainly the most popular music, was available through these. So there wasn't going to be much competition for price there.
So that was sort of the really heinous thing about this, and I don't think I really covered it very well when I was going over the facts, but I think it wasn't a matter of like 70 cents per song. It was actually, you had to pay, you had to sign up for both of these services, both MusicNet and PressPlay, and you had to pay $240 per year. And you had to do that in order to get music from all of the major labels, otherwise you couldn't do it. And if you ever stopped using the service, if you didn't repurchase the service the next year, pay them another $240, based on the DRM restrictions that were provided with the music, you would lose all of your music and you'd have to repurchase all of it.
Yeah, this was a great example of renting digital media as opposed to purchasing it. And this is a little more explicit than the way that phrase has been getting tossed around recently.
That's a pretty awesome business model if they could pull it off.
Yeah, unfortunately they couldn't. I'm looking at this and the iTunes Music Store, which offered significantly better terms, well, I don't know, it depends how you look at it. They offered, it opened in 2003, and then it offered something at least significantly closer to purchasing your music than these did. And I guess this is the same model that, you know, Napster had once Napster went legal, which is you pay a fee and you rent as much music as you want for a period of time. But I never really enjoyed that, largely because I couldn't bring any of the music with me. Did any of you guys ever use a subscription service like this?
The only music subscription service I use is Pandora, because it's $36 a year for ad-free, and I can stream it on my iPhone and on my computer, and I can set up as many stations as I want, and its algorithm is pretty useful, and I find it more convenient than trying to manage an MP3 collection, especially since once you buy a song on iTunes, you're responsible for keeping the MP3 well and happy, and if you have a hard drive crash, well, you can't really re-download it from iTunes.
I suppose the downside of using a service like Pandora, and actually I use Pandora all the time, is that you don't get to pick the songs that you want to listen to in a given moment. You leave it up to the algorithm to decide what should be played in the station, and it gets streamed to you. But still, it's pretty good.
It's kind of liberating to not need to pick your songs. Like, you just don't need to worry about it.
I prefer it.
I had an iPod Shuffle for a long time, so I guess I kind of got in the habit. Plus, if I really want to hear a song, YouTube usually has an authorized music video that I can loop.
So the University of Rochester actually had a deal with Napster for a while we were attending there when they started their legal version. And I used that for, I don't know, maybe like 10 minutes total, but I did download a song from there that still is on my hard drive, and iTunes complains every time I try to play it because iTunes does not have the authorization to play their sound file. And so it's still sitting there, and I can't listen to it, but at one point I did download it, and so that's kind of annoying.
Yeah, and to be clear, when David says when we went there, he means me and David Liu, both of us attended the University of Rochester. I never directly used the Napster service because they didn't have a Mac client at the time, so I was paying however much out of my tuition a month for a Napster service that I couldn't actually use. One interesting thing about that is Napster gave them permission to locally host all of the files on Napster. So they had a server somewhere in the university computer cluster that served all the files locally to us rather than us using bandwidth to get the server, get the music off of Napster servers. Any last thoughts about this before we move on to the next story?
Also,
I was a little curious how the licensing agreements really worked. And I thought the restrictive license agreements were, I don't know, one of the more interesting components of this, just in the deals that they had with, I guess, they were licensing this material to be sold by other distributors like Yahoo. Is that correct?
If it was, I missed that. David O'Brien, did you see that anywhere in the opinion?
I must have missed it too, actually.
Where did you see that, David? Listening.
I thought there were a couple of different brandings that they used in order to actually sell this music. I'm getting this off of the Wikipedia page, so I mean, take that with a grain of salt. But I think one of the quotes was saying that this was coming from the CEO of the Warner Music Group, I think. And it was saying that they had an affiliate model where they determined the price and the retailing partner, which I assume means Yahoo in this case, got a certain percentage of the price. And so... Go ahead.
That wasn't in the opinion, so it didn't really factor in there. At least I couldn't find anything in the opinion about it doing a quick search. It's interesting. I think that would go a little bit to the antitrust as far as, you know, the price fixing there. But yeah, it's kind of interesting. Any other questions about that, David Liu or David O'Brien?
Well, no questions. I mean, just to sort of reiterate the main point about what this this decision really meant out of the Second Circuit. And it all had to do with the pleading standards. And basically, when you file a complaint and what you contain in the complaint, you don't actually really have to prove any facts at that point, but you have to allege them. And the whole issue here is whether or not they had made enough of those allegations in order to satisfy the requirements to make a valid complaint under this particular section of the Sherman Act. And what they were really talking about is, in the complaint, what they were really alleging, I think, was more along the lines of they're inferring that there were some sort of agreements that were going on between all of the major labels, and they were saying that because of all of the major labels are in this, and because there are these pricing floors, and because we have some sort of awareness of this side agreement that went on with most favored nations clauses in it, you know, that we think is enough in this case to satisfy some sort of violation of the Sherman Act. And that was really what the Second Circuit decided here. And I think that they made a great decision, and they said, look, there's enough facts here that they have alleged that is at least plausible for a fact finder like a jury to make an inference that there was some sort of agreement that went on, and so we can let this proceed to the next you know, the next stage in litigation. And on the flip side, I mean, what the court often has to struggle with when they look at the standards for pleading is that you don't want people to be able to just file a complaint about anything and then proceed to the next stage of litigation, which is discovery, and go on basically what's a fishing expedition, trying to find those facts or those pieces of evidence that they can use to support their case if they didn't already have them when they filed the case. And what the court decided here was that there's enough allegations that you could probably infer, or you could, you have enough allegations in order to try to make a case that there was some sort of agreement that went on.
Right, and I'd like to say that the judge below who threw this out wasn't totally off base. I think she went a little too far, but this is ever since Twombly, what the pleading requirements for antitrust cases have been a moving target. Basically, the Supreme Court took pleading requirements and turned them on their head. It used to be all you need to do is plead sufficient facts so that a fact finder pleads sufficient facts for your claim. And Twombly basically said that even if you plead sufficient facts, that may not be enough. And kind of left it in this nebulous area. And you know, courts have been, you know, poking around trying to figure out what exactly you need. So, you know, the lower opinion wasn't totally off base, but I do agree with the Second Circuit here that was right. So I think we're going to move on now to the next story, which is that ValleyWag, which I believe is part of the Gawker network. So you'll see some stories that talk about ValleyWag and some stories that talk about Gawker. Put a bounty on pictures and video or actual one-on-one playtime for the Apple yet unreleased and still rumored Apple tablet. Basically, what this is was they said, you know, we're sick of all of these rumors. We're sick of nothing showing up. So what we're going to do is we're going to offer $10,000 for what we determine are bona fide pictures of the device, $20,000 for video of one in action, $50,000 for a picture of Steve Jobs holding one, and $100,000 if somebody can get one to the Gawker, or in this case, ValleyWag headquarters, and let them play with it. I believe David O'Brien sent this around to our list internally, and my first reaction was, wow, that seems actionable. Like, it seems like Apple could really, you know, go after them if anything came of that. And lo and behold, I believe 2 days later, Apple sent a cease and desist notice to the Gawker network saying, you're going to want to take that down. And if you don't take it down by by January 14th, we may sue you. And as of today, we record on Sunday, so this is Sunday the 17th, it was still up and it's still live. And to the best of my knowledge, Apple hasn't filed anything. So, Dominic, could you take us through briefly what Apple's argument was as to why the ValleyWag shouldn't have this on their website?
Sure. Basically, Apple is arguing that ValleyWag is trying to induce people to misappropriate Apple's trade secrets. And trade secrets are a branch of intellectual property law, and basically they are secrets pertaining to trade, to give a circular definition. But basically it means that if you have a trade secret, your job is to try to keep it secret from everyone else so that you can preserve that particular advantage in your particular trade. And what Gawker Media is basically saying is, here, we'll give you money if you go out and get Apple's trade secrets and bring them to us. And this is basically inducement of misappropriation of trade secrets. Misappropriation of trade secrets is basically stealing trade secrets or taking them without authorization. Apple is using California state law in particular, at least that's what they quoted in their letter to Gawker Media. But basically what they're saying is, Gawker, these are our secrets. It's our responsibility to keep our secrets, well, secret. You're trying to make people, by bribing them with money, find these secrets and then publish them so that they're not secret. So we're going to try to stop you, because part of the duty of a trade secret holder is to try to keep their secrets secret.
Right. It's a good summary, Dominic. One thing that I would like to point out is that just like copyright infringement, like we've talked about before, if you induce somebody to infringe copyright, you can be held liable. It's the same way with, in this case, what's called a business tort. A business tort is, you know, essentially a crime against a business, but instead of being prosecuted criminally, it's you go to court and you just sue somebody for, you know, to get some money out of what they did wrong, out of the wrong they did to you. So, you know, you can be held liable for inducement of trade secrets, just like you could be held liable for actually violating, revealing a trade secret inappropriately. Another interesting claim that Apple says is that you may also be inducing a breach of contract, which I think is interesting. So Apple has, no doubt what Apple's talking about is that their contracts include NDAs, or non-disclosure agreements, and that Gawker would be inducing somebody to violate this non-disclosure agreement by offering them money in exchange for breaching their contract. My question is that general knowledge that Apple has NDAs, is that enough for a breach of contract liability or induced breach of contract? Because normally you'd have to have knowledge of the contract or knowledge of, I would think, the specific terms of the contract in order to actually be liable for inducing somebody to breach it. Because if I don't know, let's say Dominic works for David O'Brien and has a contract that he's going to work for, you know, 4 straight years, and I lure Dominic away from David O'Brien's company, but I don't know about the contract, I can't induce him to breach a contract that I don't know about. Does that explanation make sense?
If you have reason to know that I'm under a contract, that's enough.
You think it's just inquiry notice like that, if I have reason to know that you're under contract?
Well, I would say that it's reasonably well known in the industry that Apple employees are under a pretty heavy NDA, and anything they reveal to you is probably something they shouldn't reveal.
And that's, you know, that's definitely pure Apple right there. Apple has this reputation of keeping all of, or at least trying to keep all of their products secret up until that point where Steve Jobs is up on the stage at one of those huge conferences and he has it in his hands and he's holding it over his head. People don't, you know, despite all the leaks that go out for all of those products, no one really knows what the product is actually going to be until it's out in Steve Jobs' hands like that. So at least to their credit, they're pretty good about keeping most things about their products secret. And definitely, I agree with what you said, Dominic. It depends a little bit on state law and what the case law says in particular about the type of knowledge that you have to have when you're talking about an inducement to breach a contract. But for the most part, it's generally accepted that if you have some general awareness that there most likely is some sort of NDA or other type of contractual relationship that's already been established, if you're inducing somebody to breach that, you can find yourself liable on the other end.
So that naturally leads us into the next question, which is, yes, Gawker Media would be liable if somebody actually breached their contract and revealed this or revealed the trade secret. Is that enough to get them or to even force them to take down this their contest? You know, aren't there First Amendment concerns about shouldn't they be allowed to publish it and then pay the consequences if anything actually comes of it?
Well, I mean, I'm not entirely clear on this particular area, but my understanding is that until they actually get that information, they haven't actually done any type of civil injury to Apple. So up until that point, they could probably keep it up. But you know, unless somebody actually comes forward from Apple who is actually under one of those agreements, you know, they haven't actually done anything wrong, and I don't know that they need to take it down. It's probably a good idea, and it's probably a good recommendation for them to take it down just to avoid any more threats from Apple or any potential lawsuits that might stem out of this. But it also might be the point, too, or it also might be another point that somebody who is not an Apple employee somehow has photographs, and they're not under any NDA or anything like that, or maybe they have a device or something like that. I don't know what circumstances that might be, but it's possible that somebody is out there that they could come forward and potentially give those photographs or whatever they have to the ValueWag site and not necessarily be in breach of, say, an inducement to breach a contract claim, or you know, also for misappropriation of trade secrets. But that would sort of be a unique circumstance.
Yeah, right. It's easy to imagine a case where somebody gives a picture to somebody who then gives the picture to Gawker, and Gawker, you know, induced it, but, you know, only two ways down. Or let's say somebody didn't even know about the ValueWag contest and gave these pictures to a friend of his, and then the friend gave them to ValueWag. That would be a case where they didn't induce any breach of contract or a breach of a misappropriation of a trade secret, but they could still post those.
Yeah, the other inherently problematic thing about this is that when there's lots of speculation about popular Apple products that have yet to be announced or released, people often will mock up Photoshops or just, you know, general modifications of photos and send them in saying, look, it's an Apple tablet. This is exactly what it's going to look like. This is it. And it, you know, it's sort of hard to authenticate.
Right. Although they did say that they weren't going to pay out any prizes until January 27th or whenever the Apple press conference is. And so only once the actual pictures of the Apple tablet are confirmed, then that's when they'll actually pay out the prizes.
Oh, that's interesting.
Right. And as for just going back very briefly to whether or not they can shut them down, whether or not Apple can shut this contest down, you know, I think it's a pretty close call because, you know, with something like you had the Harry Potter case with the Harry Potter dictionary or encyclopedia, that was a case where you could determine beforehand that this, in fact, you know, would violate J.K. Rowling's copyright. And as a result, you can say, you know, we're not going to let you publish it because if you publish it, you're going to be violating somebody else's right. Here, I think it's a little tougher because you can think of instances where Gawker's, you know, Gawker's media here, Gawker's post, you know, wouldn't necessarily lead to that inducement that they could leak out anyway and then find their way to Gawker. I think it's a relatively close call for, you know, this kind of, it's not really a prior restraint because it's already been published, but, you know, to shut it down before any wrong has come from it. Any last thoughts, Dominic or David or David?
Well, one thing that I think might, I don't know, work in Gawker's favor is that in the original post, they do say that the contest rule, their traditional contest rules apply, and they say in the section that says submission of photo, text, or other content for contests, by submitting any photo or information, represent that it does not infringe on any copyright, any rights of privacy, publicity, or any person, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, is that enough to give them some legal standing to say, look, you know, we are having this contest, but it says in our contest rules, you know, that you essentially have the rights to this photo?
Yeah, I think that's going to be a tough case to make, depending on the language of it, and I'll dig that up in a second. This is very clearly a case where they're inducing this, where they're inducing it. I don't know if that disclaimer would be enough. David or Dominic, do you guys want to weigh in?
Probably not, given that they got this nice letter.
See, the nice thing about the Apple legal team, or actually it was, I think, outside counsel that they had employed sending this letter, is it essentially puts Gawker on notice that if they do receive anything, that it's likely that those particular photos, or if they do in fact get a device, what was covered under some non-disclosure agreement, and it sort of imputes knowledge on them at that point that they're in violation of California law.
Right, and Gawker did, once Apple sent this letter, they posted a letter and said, essentially, Apple has hereby confirmed that they will be releasing a tablet by sending us this cease and desist, which, if that was their goal, it was a very clever goal and it was well executed, but Apple has sent cease and desist orders for things that have never come out before. Most notably, and they actually litigated this, somebody posted information about a product codename Asteroid that was a digital audio interface for computers, and Apple litigated it substantially to try to get the blogger who posted that information revealed and to try to get the blogger to reveal his sources, and eventually that case was dismissed, saying that bloggers have the same reporter's privileges that newspaper reporters have. But Apple has since, at least to this date, not released any product that complies with that. And you'd think that they wouldn't have gone after the person that viciously if it were not a product that were actually in development.
So any bets on whether or not Apple actually does have a tablet? I'm guessing yes, but I've been following it.
There was a story, I think, that was in the Wall Street Journal kind of recently, and it involved a purported senior Apple executive who basically confirmed that there was a tablet and that Steve Jobs is working on it, has been, you know, working on the development of it personally for some time. It sounded to be pretty legit, especially since it was published in the Wall Street Journal. But you just don't know with these things.
Yeah, there have been some rumors that that was a controlled leak from Apple, and the barometer that I use is that there's an NPR show called Sound Opinions that I really like, and I was listening to it one day, late fall, and they had a story in which they were talking about the Apple tablet, and I was like, if NPR's Sound Opinions, something that has absolutely nothing to do with technology, is talking about a rumored Apple tablet, chances are it's real, just because the rumor has permeated the culture that much. Any last thoughts before we move on?
Nope.
I will take your silence as a no. So the last case we have is a case where Apple has filed for a patent, and let me pull up the patent here. It's the patent is patent application number 170295, and we'll post a link to this in our show notes. It is a patent for adding contact to a home screen. Essentially, it's at its most basic, it's a method comprising, let's say you've got your iPhone, you've got some content associated with a contact in your iPhone, a phone number, email address, physical address. The phone receives some input to create an icon associated with that content. The phone creates an icon, and it displays it on the user interface of the mobile device. So it would be, you know, if I go to David Liu on my iPhone, I hit a button, and suddenly there's a David Liu button on the a David Liu app. You know, there's an app for David Liu on my iPhone. So, you know, I click it and either it brings up text messages from him or emails from him or, you know, directions to his home address. Now, Apple filed this patent on July 29th of 2008. And Engadget has said that this was preempted by prior art on the part of Android. So I guess right now Dominic is the one who's got the most field experience with patents. Can you give us a rundown of what prior art is, what it means, and, you know, what are the relevant dates for determining whether or not Apple can still get this patent after what Android has done with their operating system?
Sure. Prior art is basically something that the patent office... So, let's say Ben files for a patent on his new method of adding an icon to his Ben phone. And the patent office will look at what he filed and then do basically a prior art search and take a look at what else is out there and see that David has already actually come up with something very similar. And they will say to Ben, in the prosecution, it's called the prosecution of the patent, the part where you actually talk to the patent office, and they'll say, hey, we're going to reject your patent because there's this, Dave already did this. And then you will argue back and forth in prosecution saying that, well, no, what he did is different than what I did because I did this, which is above and beyond what he did. Or you basically try to distinguish, you change the claim language so that you claim around or not claim on what David did, but instead claim your new aspect, the novelty of what you did. So that's basically what prior art is. What was the other half of your question?
The other half of my question was, how does prior art relate to, you know, what Google can, you know, Google's Android does have a method for putting this a icon that represents a contact on your homepage. So is this a complete bar? Is this, and you already covered this to some degree, but I think more importantly, you know, what dates are important here?
Priority dates. So priority dates, yeah, priority dates are basically, usually they date, I believe, from filing of a patent, but you can, if you get something called a continuation, you can get it from an earlier date than you might expect. A continuation basically allows you to continue a patent application and add not exactly new material, but you can add some claims. It's been a while since I've actually done this, so don't quote me on the precision of that exactly. And if I'm wrong, please correct me. But basically,
I'm going to jump in for a second. I think you can also get priority from certain foreign filings, but not all foreign filings. But that's
right.
Really...
I think, yeah, that's a technicality in some regard. But basically, the date of filing, let's say for simplicity, and if Google filed its patent earlier than Apple filed its patent, or has a priority date available to it, it doesn't look like this particular application is a continuation, so we can lay that aside for now, then Google is going to have priority on that thing. But what Apple can do is try to distinguish around. Like, for example, in the link in the show notes, you can see that Apple has the little badge with the number on top of the contact icon in the drawing. Google doesn't have that on Android. There is no little number with a badge, and they can say, well, we are doing a contact on the home screen with a number badge that tells you how many new updates you have from that contact. That is above and beyond. It's novel. Android doesn't have it, so we get the patent on that.
Right, and you know, I said the most basic claim, but after that, there are 29 other claims, some of which depend from that first claim, where you know it's all the things that we said previously, but also when we create an icon, we create an icon based on a portion of the information available in that, you know, in that contact, you know, be it based on, you know, an image that's associated to that, or you know, a map of where the person lives, something like that. So there's definitely some room here.
I feel like there is, I mean, in my reading of the patent, I feel like there actually is a bit of material on top of, you know, just adding the icon to the home screen. Without having an Android phone, I can't really say, you know, what Android actually allows you to do. The picture we're looking at just, you know, has a picture and, you know, presumably that allows you to call them and do a couple other things. But I think the actual interesting bit of the patent was not so much just adding that to the screen, but when it's added to the screen. So there's a bit of discussion on the proximity of the other user to your particular phone. So the Engadget article called this stalking 2.0. So it's the idea that I guess there's some contextual information that's used to determine what icons appear on your phone, so that if, you know, Ben and I are in the same coffee shop, then Ben will appear on my phone so that I guess I can call him from across the room. And that also a icon could appear for that coffee shop. So that in their patent application, there's a number of different examples that they give sort of revolving around being in a coffee shop called Rocket Java. And they say that, you know, Rocket Java can have its own contextual application that pops up with, and this amused me, quote, features associated with coffee consumption. And so there's a number of, I don't know, it seemed like that there was more to it than just a picture on the home screen. It's really contextual information based on where you are and what's nearby.
So that's a really important point. And to back up a little bit, patents get granted for new inventions or some discoveries for new and useful processes or machines or other types of certain physical inventions. And that's basically what prior art goes to, is the invention must be novel and it must be non-obvious and it must be useful. And patents also do get granted for improvements on other patents or other inventions. So it could entirely be the case that even though that there are a number of prior art instances out there which seem to sort of anticipate an invention of this type, you could have it be that this is an invention which really improves upon those prior art instances in a new and useful way, and it might merit its own patent protection.
Right. One thing that, Dominic, I think you were talking earlier about a Google patent. I don't think Google's filed for a patent on this, so... And I was trying to dig up at what point this feature was added to Android operating system, and I couldn't tell. But it actually looks like a close call. So Android as an operating system was released after Apple filed the patent, but the Android developer kits were available before this happened. So if this was an Android pre-1.0, Apple may have difficulty saying, we did invent this. We invented this in-house, and we filed on this date. But you know, Google came out with Android, or at least this was available to the public before then. I guess could Apple go back and say, "Well, yes, we filed at this date, and Google released it on this date, which was before, but we invented it beforehand." Are they allowed to go back and say that you know we invented it before?
They
we
can.
Filed?
They can if they have documented proof of invention and they have basically continuity that they've been pursuing filing the patent with all due diligence ever since they invented it.
And just for a quick rundown for the listeners, what would that require, that due diligence? Would they have to be working on it every second of every day? Are they allowed to take vacations?
It's not every second of every day, and it's not unreasonable vacations. Like, they can take the holidays off if that's typically what they would do, but they can't be like, you know what, I'm going to go take a break from working on this patent for 3 months for no reason.
Yeah, you can actually also do it for financial reasons, but within a limit. Like, if you run out of money and you can't do that anymore, that's sometimes, excusable. You pursued it with diligence while you were, while you had the money to do it. On the flip side, if it would be more convenient financially for you to do it at a later time, that's not okay. You have to pursue it when you have the money, not when you feel like it.
So isn't the key not so much that they were pursuing a patent, but it's more along the lines of that they were reducing it down to some sort of working prototype of the invention?
Right, that's correct. You have to be, it's called reducing it to practice. You may have that flash of brilliance where you're like, I've got an idea for a fantastic engine, but you're really not supposed to file until you have a working engine. And it's not a requirement to have that working engine anymore, but it's certainly useful, and it would certainly help you with doing another patent requirement that's called enablement. You have to describe your invention in enough detail that people can actually go around and, practice it, that somebody can pick up the patent, and if they're skilled in the art, they can sit down and, implement that. That's part of the bargain. We'll give you a monopoly if you explain what's going, if you explain how to use this to other people. Any last thoughts on this? Dominic first.
All set.
David O'Brien.
Nope.
David Liu.
The coffee app also offers a free croissant in their example.
I do want to talk about that briefly. I think that's a great idea because right now the best way to share your contact information with somebody is an app called Bump that doesn't always work. I would love it if I could pull up my iPhone, hit, in this case, Rocket Java, see who else is in there and, introduce myself. Maybe there's some information like they're a lawyer, I'm a lawyer, great, we should talk, make a deal, have our clients meet, something like that. I think that's really cool. If everyone's still all set after that little tangent, I will end the podcast now. So we would like to thank you all for listening to the Technically Legal podcast. I'd like to add, we've had some changes. We're changing the way we're recording. We'd love to hear from you guys. So if you like what we're doing, please email us. If you have any questions, please email us. We're thinking, and this is still in the very early stages, of maybe offering continuing legal education credit. So if you're interested in that, please get in contact with us. Tell us, where you practice law. We'd love to hear from you. So you can go visit us on the website, www.technicallylegal.org. Follow us on Twitter @TechLegal. And if that's it, oh, email us, podcast@technicallylegal.org. So signing off, I'm Ben Snitkoff.
I'm Dominic Rabier.
I'm David Liu.
And I'm David O'Brien.
Thanks for listening.